Welcome to UBC Insiders On Air for the week of September 11, 2015, the show that brings you incisive commentary, interviews, analysis, and the best-informed rumor mill around on UBC campus life and politics. You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver. My name is Neil Janssen.
And I'm Ayan Kreitzman. You can always check out our website, ubcinsiders.ca, for written versions of some of what we talk about on the air, and an awesome archive full of 8 years of breaking stories and busting balls all over the university. On today's show, we have our weekly roundup. Spencer Keyes will be joining us for that. We also have some gossip and chatting with Spencer afterwards. In our third segment, we will have an interview with Daniel Monroe, who is the co-chair of the UBC Student Senate Caucus, to discuss the year ahead for UBC Vancouver Senate. To start things off, we've got Spencer Keyes in the studio with us. He's currently training to be a lawyer, and he's in third-year law at UBC.
But he's so much more than that. Spencer is an old hack, having served as AMS president in 2005-2006, and also having his awkward undergrad years chronicled in a documentary about UBC student life called College Days, College Nights, a movie I will always mention when introducing Spencer to others. Welcome to the show.
Hey, my awkward college years won a Gemini Award. I want that on the record as well.
It's kind of hard to believe that this is actually the first time I've ever met Spencer in the flesh, even though we've kind of been emailing, Twittering, whatever, commenting back and forth for 8 years, probably. And I remember that this one time, after he had sent me some document, I added him on Facebook, and he replied to me that he only adds people that he's actually met. Yeah, that hurt.
Well, you know what? It was a different time. You know, Facebook was still very fresh. The etiquette was not well-defined.
Yeah, well, we can move on from those old wounds and talk about some news items. What do we got?
Let's start with our fearless interim president. Went on a media blitz last week, wrote things for the Globe and Mail, the Vancouver Sun, gave interviews to the UBC, Global News, CBC, among others. What did you guys think about her charm offensive?
My perspective is it was classic Martha Piper. Now, I mean, I was AMS president during Martha's last year, and if there's anything you need to know about her is that she is charming, she is relentlessly positive, and her real gift has always been in external relations. And so the fact that she would be going on the offensive like this to turn the page, focus on UBC's sort of core strengths, is exactly, I think, what you would expect from her.
Yeah, she is so effective, but so annoying. Like, I thought that the UBC's headline was really on point, which was, Martha Piper sees no evil. She's so relentlessly upbeat, and the platitudes just keep rolling in.
You know what? Fair enough, but that's effective communications 101, frankly. You have a few key messages, you repeat them ad nauseum, and certainly it's very dissatisfying, particularly for people who would want to hear more about Guptagate, who want to hear more about the Board of Governors, but that's not what she was brought in to do.
Yeah, I see that. She's trying to inspire others. She's trying to inspire confidence in the institution. What else was she supposed to say, that UBC is in a crisis? Other people are going to say that lots, and
yeah, but
she's not going to.
But she mostly inspired me to never want to hear the phrase, I look forward to anything ever again.
Fair enough.
Okay, moving on. Turning to the new sub, the Perch restaurant has been open for a total of 2 days, and already some anonymous students want it to die. They've created a bringbackthegal.ca webpage referring to the gallery lounge, imploring the AMS to do something about the fact that we now have a fancy restaurant in the sub instead of a grungy place that you can buy cheap beer and sit on dilapidated furniture. What do you all think?
I mean, I think, first of all, well, there's two thoughts. One, if you actually look at the petition, I think there's something like five people who have signed it.
There's exactly five people who have signed
so
it.
I don't think that it's a particularly significant grassroots campaign. But the second part is that someone called Bring Back the Gal tried to add me to Facebook as a Facebook friend. When I took,
But of course, you haven't met this person.
I haven't met the person in real life, so I declined. But when I looked at who their friends were, they were all sort of hacks and that kind of thing, which actually led me to believe that maybe this is some sort of bizarre guerrilla marketing campaign that's coming out of the AMS to create a little controversy about the place that's at the very top of the building to get people to maybe come by and see what all the fuss is about.
Oh, I find it truly strange that there's a group of people asking other people to sign their name to this idea, but they won't tell you who they are. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like, if you want other people to sign on to your idea, you have to be the first one out there to say that I believe in this. The weird part is, what would happen if I printed out a petition thing and collected signatures? Who would I give it to? Because they're remaining anonymous, I'm not sure where I'm supposed to leave this thing.
Okay, moving on to some news out of the University Neighborhoods Association. Neil wrote about this on the blog yesterday. Well worth a read. Neil, what's the deal?
Basically, the UNA is positioning itself to annex buildings outside of its jurisdiction. There's areas on campus called neighborhoods, which is where the private housing development has been done. And up until now, they have done the obvious and sensible practice of having the UNA's jurisdiction directly mirror the borders of those neighborhoods. But they're changing a contract with UBC called the Neighbors Agreement that will allow them to essentially annex buildings outside of their borders. And this is rather unsettling.
I would be shocked if they haven't been asked to do this.
Oh, they've definitely been asked by UBC mm-hmm. to do this. UBC's planning department is behind this all the way. Basically, they've offered the UNA free money. The deal is that UBC will collect property taxes from these annexed buildings and give it to the UNA, and the UNA won't have to provide services. So they're basically getting money for nothing from UBC. And that's, you know, a surefire way of getting anyone on board with what you want to do.
So we'll have more details up on the blog. Neil is preparing a follow-up post. And also next week on the show, we have Michael White, who's the head of Camps and Community Planning, and we will for sure pick his brain about that.
Big get.
All right, well, let's move on to UBC's centennial. And can we just call bullshit on this second 100th anniversary, or is it the first 100th anniversary that we're calling bullshit on?
I'm firmly in Camp 2015. I think 2008 was absolutely ridiculous.
And so for those of you who weren't on campus in 2008, UBC had its first 100th anniversary in 2008. And what that celebrated was the passage of the University Act creating the university. And what are we celebrating this year?
I think we're actually celebrating the university itself. 1915 was the first year of there actually being classes. It was the first year of students. And so maybe I'm more of a functionalist as opposed to, ironically, a legalist. And so I definitely think that that 2015 is a more appropriate year.
So how many more centennials do we have to look forward to in the decades to come?
I found two that could be taken up by whoever the next president is. One would be in 2022 to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the Great Trek, which occurred in 1922. Or you could do 2025, which would be the 100th anniversary of classes being held on the Point Grey campus. Because, of course, when the university started, they were in what were called the Fairview Shacks near VGH. And so we could have one or two more 100th anniversaries easily.
Well, we have lots of pompous and really stupid events to look forward to. Yay! Let's move on to our unsubstantiated rumor / chatting with Spencer segment. Are there any updates that we want to talk about with Gone Gupta, as we fondly call it?
Nothing new seems to have come out. You know, in her media blitz, Piper was asked a lot about it and basically deflected it, saying she doesn't know.
The other thing about Gupta is I keep seeing Mark McLean, who's on my Facebook, writing these cryptic posts about, like, unraveling mysteries and pulling on threads, which makes me think that maybe the Faculty Association has found out something. Mark also made a comment on our episode last week, which was intriguing, that said that the Faculty Association reached out to the AMS for meetings during the Baradal affair, offers that weren't accepted. So if that's true, it's a little disappointing on the part of the AMS.
He's also been saying that they've had fairly regular contact between the Faculty Association and the university administration, but that they've also been trying to have regular contact with the Ministry of Advanced Education and the Board of Governors and have been getting basically complete silence in return.
Yeah, so we'll be having Mark McLean on the show in October, so we'll be asking him all about those things as well. So last week we talked to Aaron Bailey, and I thought it could be fun to ask Spencer what he thought, since the notable former AMS president.
Generally notable is not a good thing in the annals of the AMS.
So one thing I noticed was that Aaron sort of used his mandate as president in opposite ways. So when it was something that he did that maybe he shouldn't have done, for example, when we took him to task for the AMS press release that had more stuff in it than the corresponding council motion did, he was all like, I'm the spokesperson of the society, and I consulted council, but it was kind of out of the goodness of my heart, and I didn't have to. And then when it's about something that AMS didn't do that maybe they should have done, like maybe take a stronger stance on the whole Gupta affair and whatever, he was basically like, oh, I didn't have a clear signal from the students, and I didn't have a mandate to do that. So I was just wondering if that's straight-up manipulation, or do AMS presidents convince themselves that these are justifications?
I think that it's... No, I think it's a good question. And it's a very complicated role, because a position like this, or really a position in almost any kind of private society, is kind of peculiar and awkward. So in most, you would have, say, just a board of directors. They would be completely responsible for the operations of a society. So you have a board of directors, and it usually, in some respects, picks the person who is their spokesperson and picks the person who is going to implement policy and do all the kinds of executive functions that a president does. Of course, what the AMS does, because we have both sort of a private society blended with some sort of democratic mandate, what you have is people who report to a council but have a mandate from students. And balancing those two aspects are just always difficult. And it's never really clear what the, you know, what the appropriate thing is to do. In the case of, you know, what do students want to see, I think sometimes that is that's an intuitive call. That's inherently sort of a democratic call. That's one that says, you know what, people elected me, and so, you know, they probably elected me for my judgment. But that said, I think it's just the inherent awkwardness of the position itself. And, you know what, if you had somebody who was selected by council to be the president every year, I'm sure that you would find that they would always listen 100% to everything that council said and never step beyond it, because they would risk losing their job.
Right. The other thing that I was thinking about was the language of Aaron and student politicians in general. And honestly, it was kind of a drag to listen to, even though I enjoyed interviewing him. It was so not blunt, and there was so much long, drawn-out explication. And there was just, like, all this vocabulary, like, incorporate, iterate, individuals, instead of just saying, like, a person. Basically, Aaron has incredibly fluent politician speak programmed into his brain, and he's, like, 22 years old, and I find that, like, tragic. And this isn't to give him personally a hard time from that meeting. I think he's a talented person. And it's not just him. Lots of people sound like this. And I noticed it about Tanner and Jenna when I was at the debates earlier in the year. But I was just wondering, like, what is up with this style of talking, and where do people learn it? Seriously, where do people learn it?
I think it's a great question. And I can't speak to, you know, the reasons that anybody does that at that particular age. I can speak to my own reasons, because I was just as bad. And certainly when I read things that I wrote at that time of my life, I'm just embarrassed. Like, it's so bad. I definitely I want to, you know, chunder a little. It's not pretty. For me, there's a number of things that happened, which I then kind of bought into. One is that student politicians don't have a lot of power. They have power internally, but they don't have a lot of power externally. Whatever power or influence they get is derived from their ability to make people of who do have power in some way do things differently. And so in order to actually do that, you have to fake it till you make it. You have to seem like the smartest person in the room, even if you're not.
For me, at least, it doesn't make you sound like the smartest person in the room. It's just like this fluent politician vomit, and it just, like, white noise. I can't even pay attention anymore at a certain point.
Yeah. When you are, say, AMS president, you're working 60, 70 hours a week, you know, easily twice as much as you've ever had to work in your life. It's very easy to be in a situation where you know very little about a whole bunch of things. And so you kind of juice up what you know with words that make it seem like you know a lot more. As a function of, like, desperate survival.
And I was reading your exit interview with UBC Insiders at the end of your year in prep for this, and yeah, you did both, because you said that you had written a 60-page transition report for Kevin Keystone, who followed you, but then for us, you brought it down to 4 lines.
The 60 pages had the secrets. That's the part I didn't tell you about.
Well, I just have a question about that. So what area of law are you going to? What will you be defending us from in the future? Will it be, when we libel someone or when we murder someone, when we're caught dealing drugs?
I have a wide range of interests. it's very much going to depend. I mean, and the fact of the matter is that law is a very kind of kinetic experience. It's only when you get in there and get moving that you actually sort of realize what it is that you want to do. And so that's the advice that that lawyers with numerous years of practice under their belt have given me, and certainly I'm taking that to the bank.
So you don't know.
Yeah, that's right. So I just proved my point from the previous section. There you go.
Okay, well, we've been in the studio with Spencer Keyes. Thank you for joining us, Spencer.
Oh, thank you so much. And you know what? I've been supporter as much as one can be of UBC Insiders since the beginning, and I think you guys do a really fantastic service here. I hope this continues for a long time.
I'm Mayan Kreitzman in studio with my co-host Neil Janssen, and you are listening to UBC Insiders On Air, broadcast on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Our interview guest today is Daniel Monroe, who's here to discuss the UBC Vancouver Senate.
Daniel has been elected to sit on Senate by students in the Faculty of Arts, and as one of the three student senators with at least a year of experience, has been elected to be one of the co-chairs of Student Senate Caucus. Welcome, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
So most people on campus, if you ask them what Senate is, probably wouldn't have the first clue about it. How do you explain what the role of the Senate is, and why do you think it has such a low profile?
So in a quick kind of soundbite clip, I think Senate is the highest academic governing body at the university. This is different from the Board of Governors, which is the other highest governing body here, but they're more responsible for finances, operations, land use, etc., whereas the Senate focuses specifically on academic matters.
But what about the low-profile thing?
Senate business is pretty... I'm trying to think of what word to use to describe it. It moves very slowly, and it's kind of a tedious process most of the time. So, for example, if a department wants to create a new course, that's a really long process with a lot of long forms to fill out, and it's, to be honest, a lot of people would probably find it really boring to kind of...
Yeah, I was going to say, I think boring was the word you were looking for before.
And, I mean, for people that are on Senate, we love that kind of thing, and we think it's really exciting, but I can understand why the average student might not want to be so tapped in.
Can you explain about the Student Senate Caucus and what you guys do together?
Mm-hmm. So there are 18 students on the UBC Vancouver Senate. We meet as a group kind of before each Senate meeting to talk about what we think about what's going on at Senate that month, and to talk about our kind of guiding strategic priorities that we have.
So as a caucus, how loose or together is it? I mean, do you guys vote as a block on everything?
That is something we really decide kind of on a case-by-case basis. So when we look at the month's Senate business, we discuss things that we think are going to be more kind of controversial, and if there seems to be a consensus among us that we all want to vote the same way, then we will do so. But if there isn't an overall consensus with the whole group, then we leave it up to everyone to decide how they want to vote.
What's the purpose of having this caucus? Does it give you more influence or just keep people better informed?
I think definitely it does keep people better informed because there are so many Senate committees, and each student sits on at least a couple committees each.
So it seems to me that even when there are controversial things that go to Senate, even when the Student Senate Caucus might have a very good and principled reason for opposing the proposal and might vote against it in a block, everything always just goes through because faculty senators will seem to vote anything through. Do faculty senators really support everything, or do they just kind of rubber stamp things?
I think it depends on what the issue is. So for things like new courses, for example, and I use this example for a lot of things because this just a lot of the business at Senate is curriculum business each month. Those have usually gone through a very rigorous process and have been vetted by a lot of people. And usually, in that case, things look good. They're more of a rubber stamp in that case. For more contentious issues, like, for example, we recently approved two new streams of Vantage College. That was a bit more of a heated issue, and there was a bit better discussion kind of on the Senate floor, which included both students and faculty.
But the faculty still fully supported it, right?
I can't tell you whether every faculty member, I don't remember, but whether or not they did, they at least were willing to engage in the discussion and hear out the concerns that we had. And it goes either way. Sometimes some faculty do side with what the students are saying, but sometimes not.
So I know Student Senate Caucus has been meeting all throughout the summer, even though Senate hasn't been meeting. And I've heard that's
to get your priorities in order for the year. Do you want to quickly outline what those are?
Sure. So we have four broad priorities for the year, and I'll try to keep these as brief as I can. So the first one is assessment. So that is, we're hoping to have some more conversations at Senate about kind of the way we assess at the university. Teaching and Learning Committee formed a subcommittee to look at this issue, and we're also doing a presentation about the AMS exam prep database. So that kind of all falls within that one. The second one is mental health and well-being. So Senate recently formed an ad hoc committee on student mental health and well-being to look at how it relates to students' academic lives. And that committee is continuing forward, and we hope to push forward discussions about withdrawal policies and a fall reading break. The third one is equity and diversity in curriculum. So the President's Task Force on Intersectional and Gender-Based Violence and Aboriginal Stereotypes. A lot of recommendations that the broad university should be considering, and among those was the hope that all students would at some point in their education at UBC incorporate an element of kind of equity and diversity into their curriculum. So we're continuing to chat with the chairs of the curriculum and teaching and learning committees to try to figure out what that might look like. And the fourth kind of umbrella of priorities, we've labeled it as Senate reform, but that's probably a little bit misleading. It's more just kind of like things to do with how Senate operates procedurally. So one thing under there is that we want to just keep pushing to make sure that at kind of the Senate floor as a whole, we are able to have meaningful discussions rather than just rubber stamping everything that goes through. And also increasing the visibility of the Student Senate Caucus to students at large. And that's been mostly through resurrecting our old Twitter account and also starting a Facebook page.
Nice. I saw a post on Twitter the other day from you guys, so good job. Just to follow up on the mental health thing, why is that relevant to the Senate to deal with? I know it's, like, trendy right now.
Mm-hmm. So that was a conversation that started a couple years ago with student senators, actually. So because, like you said, it's become a really kind of trendy topic, I think student senators really realized that mental health and well-being is very tied to students' academics for obvious reasons, and they thought that the Senate should be tasked with looking at academic policies through a lens of what's best for students' health and well-being. So that led to Senate establishing an ad hoc committee to kind of review policy.
Okay, and we'll follow up more with the Senate reform issue. But first of all, we just wanted to ask about the chair of the Senate, who's the UBC president. And we were wondering how you felt that Arvind Gupta did in that role.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to really comment on how the president does in the role as chair of Senate, mainly because most of the work at Senate happens at the committee level. He's more there kind of when Senate meets as a whole to guide the meeting.
But some of the things you were talking about in terms of Senate reforms is being able to have good productive discussions on the floor of Senate. Mm-hmm. I would think the chair would have a huge role in something like that.
Yeah, so that would probably be the main area where we can kind of evaluate how President Gupta did. And I would say that he did actually do a good job of encouraging that discussion to happen. And we had even heard from him personally when he met with student senators that he was interested in making sure that that happened. And we were happy with him in that respect.
Well, so it seems like in other universities, Senate-like bodies would share more power with the Board of Governors, whereas here there's a pretty clear separation and there's this bicameral governance structure that's laid out in the University Act.
But at the same time, it seems like the Senate is sometimes thought of as an afterthought.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so we were wondering if you feel that the UBC Senate should be delegated more power.
So one thing that we have found in the past is that anytime anyone tries to raise basically issues of anything to do with money and finances at Senate, we're told, okay, we need to steer clear of this conversation because Senate is an academic body. Senate doesn't deal with money. That's for the board to look at. But I think something that we've realized and that actually some faculty senators have realized too is that for something like a new degree program, as it comes up through Senate, if we aren't able to look at the tuition at the Senate level, and the way we look at it at Senate is to see whether the tuition matches what students are getting from the program and whether it's appropriate to be able to offer the program and the resources that are needed to offer the program. If we don't really look at it at the Senate level, where there's experts who are able to do that, because we have a lot of faculty who are experts on designing curriculum and can really kind of make that judgment call, it then gets passed to board to approve the tuition, but because Senate has already approved the academic program, board doesn't really put much consideration into it, even into the tuition aspect, and it kind of just gets rubber stamped through there.
But Senate doesn't even always look at the tuition. Often curriculum proposals for new programs come to Senate with no tuition mentioned. Mm-hmm. Word gets around between students about how much the proposed tuition is, but it's not formally ever told to Senate.
Yeah, so that's something that we definitely are dissatisfied with, and we hope to have a conversation about how we can broaden that discussion at Senate.
But it's your opinion that Senate should have a role in evaluating tuition proposals?
Yes.
Because that seems like a weird blurring of the lines in the governance structure, where it is acknowledged by everyone that the board deals with money things. And, of course, the chair of the board's now in trouble for putting his fingers in academic things. Wouldn't it be equally appropriate for the Senate to be trying to, you know, put their fingers in money things?
Well, Senate does have a budget committee, which the mandate of that committee is to kind of, I guess, advise the president and the administration on issues of budget. It's been acting in the last few years more of a committee where if they need the consultation, they'll come to it and get it. And they haven't been coming to the budget committee, so it hasn't been doing very much.
Yeah, I believe their last year's report said they act almost entirely reactively.
Exactly, yeah. And I think given that the committee does have that mandate, there may be a role to kind of take a more active stance on.
Yeah, it seems like those two things are kind of inseparable sometimes, especially when you're establishing a new program. And maybe that leads us to our sort of next issue, which is that UBC seems to be adding all these new programs that are designed for revenue-generating potential, maybe sometimes more so than for academic merit.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we're talking about program. You probably have your own list, but Master of Engineering and Leadership, Bachelor and Master of Management, and the program whose name escapes me where they were accepting people in solder before Senate had even approved it.
So I wouldn't say that Senate has been an afterthought. I would say that Senate has been relegated to only considering the academic merit of those programs. And for the
Hold on, wasn't there a program where solder was granting acceptances to students before Senate had even approved the program?
So that issue was raised at Senate, and what we were told was that...
What program was this?
It was a solder program about global resource management, I believe. I can't remember exactly what the title of the program was. But the program was brought to Senate, and then after looking at the program's website, we saw that they seemed to be accepting students applying to the program, and it seemed to indicate that it was supposed to start in September 2015. When that issue was raised at Senate, we were told, oh, that was a mistake. The program actually begins in September 2016, and the fact that the application form was on the website was
not presumptuous at all. Yeah, a clerical.
So that's the answer we got. They took it down, and they're not accepting students. You can read into that what you will.
Or I guess they are for next year, right?
For 2016. But now the program's been approved, so.
Okay. And obviously the biggest example of these revenue-generating programs is Vantage College that UBC has gotten a lot of flack for. And just to tell people what it is, Vantage is the big building that's going up behind Macmillan, which paved over what used to be the Orchard Garden. And it accepts only international students whose English proficiency scores aren't good enough for UBC admission. And the whole point of the program, which costs $33,000 with a mandatory $17,000 residence fee on top of that, is supposed to be to give students English language help so that they transition into being UBC students in the second year. But, you know, I mean, I've heard rumors that Vantage College isn't even going to make money. Its enrollment is lower than what it was expected to be, and instead of being a cash cow, it's going to be a drain. For me, like, this is where I see Senate having opportunities to act as a sort of check to schemes from the Board of Governors. Would you say that the Senate played a meaningful role in establishing Vantage College and envisioning what it is?
It's hard for me to comment on that specifically because I wasn't around when Vantage College was first established. I can say that when issues of Vantage College have gone to Senate since then, like approving the new streams of commerce and applied science students, we have had pretty good discussions at the Senate floor about those. One area where the students wish we could have had more discussion over the last year was kind of getting updates from Vantage College and from the Provost's Office about how the program's going, how students are adjusting, and kind of the evaluation they've done of the programs over the last year. We, as students, actually requested that to come to Senate a couple times, and that they failed to do so before bringing forward two new streams. So it was a bit disappointing to us that they wanted us to approve two new streams of students when they hadn't even shown us evaluation of how the program was going.
And did you guys vote against that?
We chose not to pick a block stance, but I believe the majority of student senators voted against the new streams, not because we didn't like the curriculum or we didn't like the new programs, but because we just didn't have confidence that the evaluation had been done.
Well, and one of the things as well that the Senate considered on Vantage was the English language requirements. And Senate ultimately decided that there would be no exit testing for Vantage College students for their English skills, and that simply completing the program was proof of their English proficiency. So this seems really strange as well in the context that they don't want to evaluate themselves and show how they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Again, like, my view is not anti-Vantage College or anything. I just think they need to be showing more evidence of assessment.
But doesn't that lead into the reasons they've been getting flack for it, which is that it seems like a way that people with means can buy their way around the usual requirements to get into UBC?
I don't quite think that that claim is substantiated when you do look at the fact that the language requirement is not much lower than the normal language requirement for a UBC student. It's students whose English is just slightly worse than the average UBC admittent, and built into the curriculum really is a lot of stuff around kind of language learning. So I am confident that students are graduating from the program prepared to start their second year. But again, just because I think they probably are, that doesn't mean they shouldn't be doing evaluation of whether that's the case.
I guess I'm just wondering in general, for these revenue-generating academic programs that are mushrooming up everywhere, how active do you feel that the Senate is in providing like a strategic opinion on whether these things are worth doing?
Yeah, so I think Senate has played a role in looking at programs in the context of UBC's strategic priorities as a whole, not in terms of the money side of things. I think especially at the curriculum committee level, there is a desire to contextualize programs within what's going on at UBC and to see whether they really fit. So I would think